Turkey is set for a runoff vote on May the 28th, as neither the president nor his main rival were able to secure an outright majority. Palestinians mark the 75th anniversary of the creation of Israel, known as the Nakba Day, amid global pro-Palestine rallies. And Russia slams Britain's decision to supply Kiev with more military hardware, saying the move will not change the course of the conflict in Ukraine. Welcome. Live from Tehran, you've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to Turkey, which is headed for a presidential election runoff after the two leading candidates fell short of a majority needed for an outright win. Incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan led the first round with 49.51% of the ballots. His main rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, secured nearly 44%. Now, the two will face off on May the 28th. Both candidates had already expressed readiness for a second round. Addressing his supporters in the capital, Ankara, Erdogan said he has a clear lead over his main rival, but he's ready for a runoff if required. He also took aim at Kılıçdaroğlu's campaign, saying they're trying to fool the people with the wrong figures. Meanwhile, Kılıçdaroğlu, speaking alongside the leaders of other parties in his alliance, said he would win the potential runoff. He also took a jab at Erdogan, saying he would not achieve the result he wanted in Sunday's vote. Roshan Saklam joined us earlier with more on Turkish presidential elections. We also asked her about the chances each candidate has in the May 28th runoff.
If we want to speak about their chances in this rerun, many are talking that President Erdogan may have better chances at winning for several reasons, one of which is that the third candidate that did not allow those two main candidates to become the president, who is Sinan Ogan from the ATA alliance, he got 5.6%. Those percentage, although those voters who voted for Sinan Ogan are supposed, of course, in the second rerun to go to one of the two other candidates. However, if you want to speak about it in a political way, none of the voters, I think, that voted for Sinan Ogan will vote to the opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, if he continues his agreement with the Kurdish party, HDP. Because Sinan Ogan comes from a very national background. He comes from the MHP, the nation party. Mm-hmm. So he comes from a political party that is against any other, if we want to say it, other than Turks.
Thousands of Palestinians have rallied in the West Bank city of Ramallah to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, or the catastrophe. Nakba Day refers to the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. At that time, Zionists who had moved to Palestine from different countries drove over 750,000 Palestinians into exile. They also wiped out more than 500 Palestinian towns and villages off the map. Similar Nakba Day rallies have also been held in many countries over recent days, particularly in West Asia. Ralliers are calling on the international community to take action to stop Israeli atrocities. This year, the United Nations commemorates the occasion for the first time.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora, the Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out. Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanctuary. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here. International law to be applied to Israel. Sanction Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long. And we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Step by step, down Constitution Avenue in the United States Capitol, protesters make their demands known, an independent Palestinian state.
Palestinians are here commemorating the Nakba, the 75th year in which the settler colonial entity began its illegal military occupation of Palestine.
Hundreds gather in Washington, D.C. to raise awareness of Palestinian oppression under Israeli occupation. The translation of Nakba means catastrophe. The event marks the displacement of 750,000 Palestinians from their ancestral homes in Palestine and the destruction of 500 villages and towns.
We know that Zionism is an ideology and a practice of racism and colonialism and was never in actuality a mission for the safety of our people. And we know that it is attempting to keep us from a future in which we respect instead of fear one another.
But many here insist that the Palestinian displacement is just as much a part of the present as it is a part of the past.
I mean, it burns us up when we watch the TV and we see what's going on, when we talk to our relatives overseas, see what's going on. This is the least we can do. We have to let our voices be heard.
Abed Kadir drove more than an hour to the protest and rally that started at the Washington Monument. For others, the current plight of Palestinians triggers outrage, regardless of faith.
It's against Judaism. It's against Judaism as a religion. Judaism is a religion. Zionism is nationalism. It's nothing to do.
Protesters have gathered here from across the United States. They're encouraging drivers-by to honk in solidarity with them. They're marching on Congress to demand that the United States do more to protect the security of Palestinians.
Many of the protesters' chants targeted United States support for Israel's military, with some calling for President Joe Biden to take stronger action against the regime.
We stand here today to share that we stand defiantly against our colonial aggressors and that we will never give up Palestine and that the youth in Palestine and the youth in the diaspora are connected.
There were plenty of signs at this demonstration from End the Occupation to Black Lives Matter. However, there is little indication that the U.S. will take bold political action to improve the lives of Palestinians, to end violence, or encourage their liberation. Colin Campbell, Washington.
as the world marks the Nakba Day, Pakistanis take to the streets, raising their voices and banners, standing shoulder to shoulder with Palestinians. This day holds immense significance for people, reminding them of the struggles faced by Palestinians and their right to return to their homeland.
75 years ago, the Nakba, or the catastrophe, struck, resulting in the forced exile of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their ancestral homes. Today, Muslims around the world gather to remember the occasion and express support for Palestinians.
The participants condemned the long-standing inaction and passive behavior of the international community towards the suffering of Palestinians.
On this day, in 1948, we witnessed that hundreds and thousands of Palestinian people, they were forcibly expelled from their homeland, Palestine, towards Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and different countries. So, as your question, why the day of return is important, yes, this is the just-based solution. If the Palestinian people will return to their homeland and they will decide their future, no other country, no other regime, no other government have any rights.
Also, a pictorial exhibition of Palestinian struggle was put on display before Karachi Press Club at the end of the rally.
All over the world, where there's a violation of human rights, all of the countries, America, United Nations, was stand by them. But only in Palestine, they have silence because they support Israel. And the policy behind supporting Israel is that to Palestine, to deny the rights of Palestine. That's why the human rights violation is keep on silencing.
It is a stark reminder that the creation of Israel in 1948 resulted in the expulsion of approximately 750,000 Palestinians from their ancestral homes. Today, over 5 million Palestinian refugees and their descendants remain displaced, and the international community has failed to resolve the issue. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Meanwhile, Iran has reaffirmed its support for Palestinians, calling for the Israeli regime to be held accountable for its brutality against Palestinians. In a statement to mark Nakba Day, Iranian Foreign Ministry said Israel's recent bombardment of the Gaza Strip was a grave violation of basic international law and human rights principles. It said the silence and inaction of the Israeli regime's Western sponsors, who pretend to be human rights defenders, has further emboldened Israel to go on with its repression of Palestinians. Now, the statement reiterated Iran's previous proposal that all the original inhabitants of Palestinian lands and their descendants must return to their homes, and a referendum should be held there to determine the future of people there. The five-day Israeli aggression on Gaza has finally come to an end. Dozens of people, including women and children, were killed during the recent Israeli onslaught on the besieged coastal territory. Yet the international community has failed to take any concrete measures against the Israeli regime for its atrocities against Palestinians. Well, in the past several years, Palestinian resistance groups have managed to enhance their military capabilities in the face of Israeli adventurism. The latest aggression and the assassination of resistance commanders not only has increased the resolve of the Palestinian resistance against an occupying regime, but has also united all factions in their struggle to liberate Palestine. Moving on to other news this hour, Russia has blasted a recent decision by the UK to supply Ukraine with more military aid. The Kremlin spokesman says Moscow has an extremely negative view of London's decision. Dmitry Peskov says the move will not change the course of the conflict in Ukraine. The reaction follows President Volodymyr Zelensky's meeting with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in London. The UK has pledged to deliver air defense missiles and long-range attack drones in the coming months. Well, Britain became the first Western country to offer long-range cruise missiles to Kiev last week. Thai opposition claims a victory after an election result that left the Move Forward Party the biggest implement. A massive search for the MFP in Sunday's ballot left it on course to be the biggest party, followed by another opposition, namely the Phu Thai Movement. The opposition parties were contesting against former coup leader and Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha. The United Thai Nation Party, led by the ex-army chief, who seized power in a 2014 coup, stood a distant third. Now the MFP leader says he's ready for taking the role of prime minister.
People of Thailand have already spoken their wish. And I am ready to be the prime minister for all, whether you agree with me or you disagree with me. I have congratulated Khun Pae Thong Thanh from Pheu Thai for her hard-fought campaign and have invited her to join the coalition. And that includes five more parties in the previous opposition.
PETA also repeated a promise to reform a law that imposes harsh prison terms for insulting the monarchy. Around 52 million people were eligible to vote. The new premier will be chosen jointly by the 500 elected MPs and the 250 Senate members appointed by the junta. President Joe Biden has once again warned of catastrophic consequences for the nation's economy if the country defaults on its debt payments. Well, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has forecast that the country could default on its debts by June the 15th if lawmakers fail to agree to raise current limits on government spending. For weeks, U.S. policymakers, bankers, and the White House have warned that the U.S. is on the brink of default, which could plunge the country into a recession and see millions of jobs lost. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed upon first. U.S. national debt currently stands at around $31.5 trillion. A default would also trigger a global economic downturn. Well, it's a month into Sudan's brutal war, and yet no end in sight. The Sudanese army continues to pound parts of the country's capital. Now, the army's airstrikes are targeting paramilitary rivals around a hospital, which has been damaged in the bombardment. The fighting has spread to several regions, including Darfur, but it's concentrated in the capital. This despite ongoing talks brokered by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. aimed at securing a ceasefire. Last week, the Army and the RSF agreed to a declaration of principles to protect civilians and to secure aid access. But enforcement mechanism and a ceasefire are still being discussed. Now, the war began after disputes over integrating the RSF into the Army as well as the chain of command in a new political transition. And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldless Edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
in the limelight.
At least 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, have been killed in the recent Israeli regime bombing campaign. This is while Biden administration quietly backs the Zionist regime's deadly assaults on Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Truthout noted, it should come as no surprise that the United States has fully backed the Zionist regime in its recent assault against Gaza. In the hours before the Zionist regime began raining down more bombs on the besieged territory, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with the Zionist regime Foreign Minister Eli Cohen over the phone. While the readout of their call did not mention what war at the time, escalating tensions with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, it is certain that the matter was discussed and that the Zionist regime's intention to bring still more devastation to Gaza did not catch the United States by surprise. Yet, as always, the U.S. response, or lack thereof, is important and needs to be examined. Under President Joe Biden's administration, the U.S. silent support of virtually all Israeli regime actions against the Palestinians has remained as absolute as it was during the administration of Donald Trump, despite growing unease with the Zionist regime's behavior among the majority of Americans. In the occupied territories, the assault on Gaza and the commitment rocket fire coming into southern occupied territories have served to provide a temporary scab over the fracture in the Zionist regime society caused by the current government's efforts to destroy the democracy. In the United States, it has allowed the people to more easily ignore this growing authoritarianism mere days ahead of 75th anniversary of the Zionist regime's Nakba. The argument that Israel has the right to defend itself has quickly made the rounds, and with it, the narrative that the rockets launched from Gaza were random, unprovoked, and expressions of an irrational Palestinian desire to kill Israelis. The reality is, of course, very different, and its burial is a key strategic component that must be countered. On May 2nd, PIJ spokesperson and activist Khazar Adnan died in an Israeli regime prison after an 87-day hunger strike. Despite his outspoken advocacy for resistance and activism in PIJ, the fabricated regime of Israel never charged Adnan with any act of violence. He died after the Zionist regime refused to transfer him to the hospital, despite warnings that his condition was life-threatening. Many viewed Adnan's death as killing by deliberate inaction, and rockets were launched from Gaza while protesters confronted the Zionist regime security forces in the West Bank. A ceasefire and the quiet day-to-day occupation and Israeli regime dominance briefly resumed. But some in the occupied territories were dissatisfied that the Israeli regime response was not harsher. Itamar Ben-Gvir, the radical Kahani's minister of internal security, boycotted government activity and even raised the specter of quitting the government if the Zionist regime prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not move to do more damage to Gaza. We'll be right back. Netanyahu denied this was the reason for breaking the fragile ceasefire that was reached after May 2nd, but in any case, the Zionist regime launched its latest operation and, in the first wave, killed not only three PIJ leaders, but 10 others, including the entire family of one of those targeted. In all, at least 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, have been martyred. In this case, it is clearer than usual that this was in no way the Zionist regime defending itself. The fabricated regime of Israel provoked the entire episode by killing Khadr Adnan through willful neglect. Then, when a brief escalation was stopped, the Zionist regime made the decision, whether due to Ben-Gvir's pressure or not, to attack not only PIJ in a blatantly illegal extrajudicial killing, but to do so by bombing their residences, when their spouses and children would be sleeping and at their most defenseless. Despite reports that the Biden administration was urging the Zionist regime to find a way to resume the ceasefire, the Israeli regime continued its airstrikes against Gaza. PIJ rockets continued to fly from Gaza in response, and while the overwhelming majority of these either fell harmlessly or were intercepted, one did strike a residential building in a Tel Aviv suburb, causing a fatality which will mean ongoing escalation. Netanyahu stated that the attacks on Gaza would continue as long as necessary, a clear indication that any pressure from Washington was not serious. Indeed, senior Biden administration officials, including National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and Ambassador to the Occupied Territories Tom Knights, were all unified and unequivocal in their full support of the fabricated regime of Israel, barely paying lip service to hope for a ceasefire.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
The theme that I've been talking about in this majalis is basically to see those who are close to Amir al-Mu'mineen so that we can relate to them, look at them as role models and examples of what does it mean to be Shia of Ali. Ammar bin Yasir is known as one of the Al-Arkan al-Arba'a, one of the four pillars of the support of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Ammar, you know, he has been praised by the Prophet in many different ways. There is one hadith accepted by Shias and Sunnis both where the Prophet says, اشتاقت الجنة إلى علي وعمار وسلمان وبلال. The Jannah is waiting or longing for Ali, Ammar, Salman, and Bilal. One day Ammar came to visit the Prophet, so he basically asked permission from outside that I would like to come in. And the Prophet told his servant there, إِذَنُ لَهُ. allow him to come. But then the way he addressed him, he says, Marhaba bi-tayyibi ibn al-tayyib. You know, Ammar is tayyib, pure, and he is son of a pure one. When the Masjid al-Nabi was being built, at the time, even the Prophet was, you know, helping his companions. At that time, there was some argument, and I don't want to go into details. We don't have that much time today. Where somebody criticized Ammar. And Ammar was actually carrying double of the load of others. Not one brick, two bricks, for example. And so when there was one of the prominent Sahaba was basically was you know criticizing him. So Rasulullah said, leave him alone. And he called Ammar close, and he wiped the sweat from his forehead. And then the Prophet says, you know, that he is someone, إِنَّكَ مِنْ أَهَلِ الْجَنَّةِ تَقْتُلُكَ الْفِئَةُ الْبَاغِيَةِ. You are from the people of Jannah and you will be killed by a rebellious group. In what state? Ammar will be killed, يَدْعُوهُمْ إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ, while he will be calling them towards Jannah. And those who killed him, يَدْعُونَ إِلَى النَّارِ, will be calling him towards Jahannam. And this hadith was there at that time, but it became a very crucial point in the discussion between Shias and Sunnis later on. And you see that, you know, he was among those who were with Amir al-Mu'mineen in the house of Fatima al-Zahra to protest against the bay'at of Abu Bakr. And even after that, especially during the time of Usman, he was a very strong, you know, vocal critic of the unjust policies of Usman about the way mismanaging the Baytul Mal, the public treasury. For example, Arqam bin Abdullah, who was the treasurer during the time of Usman, one day Usman told him to, you know, set aside 100,000 dirham. He said, I can do that, but I'll make a note that this is a loan that you have from Baytul Mal. And Usman became very angry. He said, what do you mean? You are my treasurer. He said, no, I'm not your treasurer. I am treasurer of the Muslims. You appointed me to handle Baytul Mal. This is public's property. And he became so angry, abused him, you know, and dismissed him. Rather, I would say, you know, the treasurer quit. He said, I cannot do any work with you anymore. And then Usman goes on the minbar and he says, oh people, when Abu Bakr came, he preferred his tribe over others. When Umar came, he preferred his tribe over others. And therefore, I will prefer my own tribe of Banu Umayyah over others. And nobody can say anything about what I'm doing. If I'm given the right to be at the door of Jannah and the privilege to admit people, I will bring all the Banu Umayyah into Jannah. Look at their affiliations. And this is whether people like or not, this is our property. And this is where when Ammar heard about it, one of the cases where he openly opposed Usman was on this issue. Where Usman comes down from the minbar and starts kicking Ammar to the extent that Ammar became unconscious. You know, they talk about Shias being, you know, oh, they don't believe in Sahaba, don't respect Sahaba. What is this? You know, and this is where the story goes on. You know, he even decided then to exile Ammar the way Abu Zar was exiled. Until Banu Makhzum, the tribe that he was affiliated to, they came to Ali, said, can you go and, you know, convince Usman not to do this? And because of the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Usman let him stay in Medina. The hadith of the Prophet about Ammar, that, you know, you will be killed by the rebellious group, this became a problem because Ammar was with Amir al-Mu'mineen in Siffin. And he was killed in Siffin at the hand of the forces of Muawiyah there. And at that time, many people didn't remember that hadith of Rasulullah about Ammar. But the day he was killed, Abdullah bin Amr ibn As, son of Amr ibn As, who used to write the hadith of Rasulullah for his own notes, immediately said, "Oh, Rasulullah said that he will be killed by the rebellious group." So even those who are still, you know, on the fence on this issue of who is on haq, who is on batil in Safin, on that day they realize haq is with Ali and Muawiyah is batil. And when Abdullah bin Amr ibn As mentioned this hadith, remembered that, it became like a wildfire among the Syrian forces. And Muawiyah told Amr ibn As, "Can you not put a rein on the mouth of your son? Why does he have to say everything that he heard from Rasulullah?" Because it became a public relations nightmare for him. And Amr ibn As says, "Well, there is a solution to it. Why don't you spread words among your soldiers that the person responsible for the killing of Ammar is the person who brought him to Safin?" You know, this crooked thinking of blaming the victim. That we didn't kill him, the responsibility goes on the person who brought him here. When Amir al-Mu'mineen heard about it, he laughed. He said, "It means Rasulullah is responsible for the killing of Hamza, because he took his uncle to Uhud." And this is where, you know, we see that this hadith even now becomes, even the shahadat of Ammar became a point of support for the vilayat of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Ali. حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears." Thank you.
in the limelight.
Uncertainty about the U.S. government's debt ceiling of $31.4 billion has added to global economic concerns. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, has warned that there is a very high risk of default in the first 2 weeks of June, when the U.S. government is likely to run out of money and to default on its debts. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has covered this story and tells us more. The Washington standoff over raising of the U.S. government's $31.4 trillion borrowing limit is adding to global economic worries, as a new nonpartisan congressional report cited a significant risk of a historic default within the first 2 weeks of June. The U.S. Congressional Budget Office, the CBO report, issued on Friday morning, 12th of May, confirms Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's earlier warnings that a default could come as early as 1st of June. The Congressional Budget Office warned there is significant risk that at some point in the first 2 weeks of June, the government will no longer be able to pay all of its obligations. Congress Budget Scorekeeper also noted that the federal government's debt payments will remain uncertain throughout May, even if the Treasury ultimately runs out of funds in early June. President Joe Biden and his Democratic colleagues in Congress have urged prompt action to raise the $31.4 trillion statutory limit on government borrowing without conditions since the beginning of the year. Republicans, who narrowly control the House of Representatives, want new limits on future spending nailed down before they give the green light on more payments to cover borrowings on previously enacted spending. At a meeting of the Group of Seven finance ministers in Japan, World Bank President David Malpass said the looming risk of a default, which would be the first in U.S. history, was adding to problems facing the slowing global economy. David Malpass told Reuters news agency on the sidelines of the G7 finance ministers' meeting, "Clearly, distress in the world's biggest economy would be negative for everyone." In the coming days, President Biden is scheduled to attend the G7 leaders' meeting in Niigata, Japan, but recently said he could cancel his trip if he and congressional leaders were not making enough progress towards a debt limit increase. A meeting between President Biden and Democratic and Republican congressional leaders that had been tentatively planned for Friday, 12th of May, was postponed as both sides haggle over what spending could be cut in the 2024 budget. The standoff was starting to show its effect outside of Washington. On Friday, the University of Michigan reported its twice-monthly reading of consumer sentiment showed households have the bleakest view of the economy in the past 6 months, in no small part thanks to the debt ceiling showdown. Survey director Joanne Hsu said in a statement, "Year-ahead expectations for the economy plummeted 23% from last month." The U.S. newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. Wall Street, too, has been fretting over a potential debt default. U.S. stocks fell after the sentiment data showed households growing concerns about the situation, while yields on Treasury securities maturing in the first half of June remain significantly elevated relative to later maturing debt. While staffs toiled behind closed doors, lawmakers blamed each other for the turmoil. Referring to former President Donald Trump's Make America Great Again movement, Joe Biden said, MAGA House Republicans are threatening to default on America's debt unless we give in to their demands. Biden warned that Republicans may cut funding for thousands of jobs, including National Park Rangers and firefighters. Republican Representative Anthony Desposito tweeted back to President Biden. He said, "Mr. President, stop lying," claiming the president was refusing to negotiate with Republicans in good faith. Biden and his cabinet have said repeatedly a default would be catastrophic. They warn U.S. bonds are the foundation of the global financial system, and a default would rattle global markets and could trigger a recession. On the sidelines of the G7 finance ministers' meeting in Japan, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Wall Street leaders and business owners to speak out about how the fight over a debt limit was affecting economies and causing a grave level of uncertainty. Janet Yellen intends to discuss the current impasse in the coming days with leading bankers. A senior Treasury official said she would do that with board members of the Bank Policy Institute lobby group. With the battle in Washington dragging on, one House Democrat floated an idea that might get lawmakers' attention. Democratic Representative Abigail Spanberger said members of the U.S. Congress ought to have their paychecks withheld until the debt limit problem is resolved. Congress has raised the debt limit to roughly $31.4 trillion in late 2021, but not without months of drama between both sides of the aisle, as Republicans tried to use the task as a leverage point to secure concessions from Democrats, who instead pushed for a clean increase with no preconditions. Congress finds itself in similar terrain yet again, as a GOP-led House vows not to raise the debt ceiling unless Democrats agree to significant spending cuts. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. Analysts have warned homeowners could see mortgage rates rocket to 8.4% if the US defaults on its debt, after they fell to 6.35% in recent days. US President Joe Biden has less than 1 month to stop the country defaulting for the first time in history, after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned the government may not be able to pay its bills by 1st of June. If a solution is not reached, households face fiscal chaos, which could cause 7 million jobs to be lost and investment to plummet. Experts from property website Zillow have estimated that such an outcome could cause mortgage rates to soar as high as 8.4% by September. Zillow warned this would push up the cost of an average mortgage repayment by 22%. Recent figures from lender Freddie Mac showed that the average rate on a fixed-rate 30-year mortgage was now 6.35%, down from 6.39% a week earlier. Jeff Tucker, a senior economist at Zillow, said home buyers and home sellers finally have been adjusting to mortgage rates over 6% this spring, but a debt default could potentially raise borrowing costs even higher and send the market into a deep freeze. Jeff Tucker added, home values might not see a notable drop, but higher mortgage rates would severely impair affordability, for first-time buyers especially. He added, it was critically important that lawmakers found a solution before a default occurs. On Monday, 8th of May, President Biden went toe-to-toe with Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy in their first meeting in over 3 months. The two men are entrenched in opposing views, as President Biden wants to raise the debt ceiling to stop a default. However, Kevin McCarthy has insisted the measure will not pass through Congress. President Biden is now considering using the 14th Amendment to push through an increase to the debt ceiling, though he expressed reservations about doing so. The 14th Amendment says the validity of the public debt authorized by law shall not be questioned. However, today, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen condemned the idea as legally questionable.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023. The Israelites practiced resistance in Egypt under Pharaoh for many years. Of course, they ruined everything later on, but they resisted for many years. It was this resistance that brought Moses to them. He started his movement and they followed him. This led to the destruction of Pharaoh and his system. This is what awaiting the reappearance of the Savior is about. Awaiting the reappearance means anticipating the removal of all the lacks that you just mentioned. The number of lacks that exist is 10 times more than this, but you didn't mention all of them. This is what awaiting the reappearance means. It means being prepared. It means you need to think. And it means not imagining yourself to be at a dead end. This imagining that you are at a dead end is a very bad thing. This is the meaning behind awaiting the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. You need to keep these things in mind. Of course, the Almighty God has repeatedly said in the Quran, Allah has ordained that I shall surely prevail, I and my messengers. The Holy Quran, Surah 58, verse 21.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Allah has ordained means that it is definite in God's law that the way of the prophets will prevail. There is no room for discussion on this. Allah will indeed defend those who have faith. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 38. God will defend the believers. There is no doubt about this. And the Holy Quran also says, we desired to show favor to those who were oppressed in the land and to make them imams. Surah 28, verse 5. No doubt exists in this. It is the promise of Almighty God. We have seen these realities ourselves. Now, there was a time when we used to quote these things from the Qur'an, Nahjul Balagha and Sahifa Sajjadiyya, but now we have seen these things in our own lives. Now, you are still very young. God willing, when you have lived to be 10 or 20 years more than I am now, you shall see many things. Me, at this age, I have seen this myself. I witnessed the victory of the revolution. It was a victory of truth over falsehood. No one thought or imagined that it could succeed.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.